Today's show is sponsored by Echonos, maker of Cosmos. The Cosmos ultrasound has a lot of incredible AI capabilities that can be really helpful in teaching and learning ultrasound. It labels the anatomy, grades the quality, then can help guide a learner to fix their image. In addition, there's even an auto EF calculation that's been tested and held up in real-world studies on patients. The technology in this system has the potential to flatten the learning curve for your learners and help them with self-directed or proctored learning. Check out more at echonos.com/gel podcast. Use the promo code GEL to receive your limited time special offer. That's echonos.com/gel podcast.
Ultrasound Gel Podcast. Ultrasound Gel Podcast.
Welcome to the Ultrasound Gel Podcast. I am Cray Bolger, joined by Jalen and Mike. Hello, friends.
Howdy.
Hi.
And today, Mike is going to start us off with a case, and then we're going to hop right into a rebirth of MAPSE, guys.
So this case is about venous air embolism, and has a pretty scary title, Fatal Venous Air Embolism in the Setting of Hemodialysis and Pulmonary Hypertension, a Point-of-Care Ultrasound Diagnosis. This is about an 82-year-old who was admitted to the ICU with hypoxic respiratory failure while undergoing routine dialysis, became hypotensive despite the norepinephrine that they were on. They noted that there was a, quote, column of air in the dialysis line. That's not something you want to see usually. So they astutely placed the patient on their left side, but didn't get any improvement. At that point, they did an ultrasound and it showed a lot of air bubbles in the RV outflow tract. So they started to suspect that this was, well, they probably started to suspect it when they saw that column of air. This kind of confirmed what they were concerned about, that there was a venous air embolism. Now, in this case, the patient did ultimately expire despite their efforts, but I think it highlights that it's very important to recognize the appearance of air, whether it's somewhere you expect it to be or not. So if you ever see air in the wrong place, such as inside the ventricles or in the cardiac chambers anywhere, that should be concerning. Now, I'm not talking about those little bubbles where if you're given a fluid bolus or you're doing your flush after doing a central line, I think that's understandable. But I had a case once very similar to this, where there was just tons and tons of air with that dirty shadowing inside the ventricle walls. That's alarming that there is some sort of gas embolism, and you should know how to treat that. So after that sobering story, let's move on to our main article.
That's an insane case. It's one of those findings that you obviously like never really want to see. And I always have to like put a little caveat when I get excited about like these kind of like rare kind of big deal things. I don't ever mean to imply that I am excited this happens to people. If it happens, I think using this as an educational like thing to maybe avoid an actual fatality in the future is the whole point of this and why we talk about it. Now, the article we're going to talk about today is Focused Cardiac Ultrasound with Mitral Annular Plain Systolic Excursion, or MAPSE, Detection of Left Ventricular Dysfunction. It was published in the American Journal of Emergency Medicine in 2023, June specifically. Shout out to Kristen Dyer. She's a friend of mine, ultrasound person. I don't really, unfortunately, know anybody else in that study, but love Kristen. She's amazing. So shout out to her. Now, for as long as we have scanned hearts, we have been interested in knowing the LV systolic function. This is actually pretty important for us. An important consideration in the patient's physiology is that how well is their ejection fraction? Now, there is multiple ways to do this, but there is more than one way to peel this potato. And I think it's important, just side note, that we stop using idioms that are violent towards animals. Now, often the standard for comprehensive echoes is tracing the endocardium's borders in one or more dimension and then calculating the ejection fraction based on the comparison of the chamber sizes in systole and diastole. Now, not all machines or people who scan patients are capable of this method, obviously. Therefore, there are easier methods that have been devised and popularized. A couple of examples are fractional shortening, the EPSS, or the E-point septal separation, or the one that I usually use, honestly, which is just eyeballing it, which is just, you just look at it and you can kind of see, is it good? Is it really low? Or is it really high? But instead of using one of these ones that we kind of already talk about and already know, the authors wanted to look at this thing called the MAPSE, or the mitral annular plain systolic excursion. We've seen a bit of good branding with the TAPSE, which is the tricuspid annular plane systolic excursion. So it's of the RV function. And a bit of a side note there is that the ventricle on the left side and the right side don't actually contract exactly the same. The RV contracts a bit more on the kind of longitudinal axis, whereas the LV is a little bit more of a circular contraction. So they don't exactly work the same way, but it exists for the left heart as a MAPSE and the right heart as TAPSE. Now, this might explain why, although the MAPSE is not a new measurement, that it's not really used that much clinically. Now, that being said, it's still a fair question to know how well this option to measure stands up with other things that we can use to estimate the ejection fraction for us point of care providers. And that is what this article is asking specifically.
So their question is, does the MAPSE, as measured by emergency physicians, predict a decreased LVEF compared to the reference standard of a comprehensive echocardiography? And then secondarily, they said, what is the inter-rater reliability and test performance compared to EPSS, the E-point septal separation, and a good old visual estimation of that EF? So the way they performed this study, this was from 2018 to 2021 in an urban academic emergency department. They included anybody with symptoms concerning for heart failure, such as shortness of breath, peripheral edema, chest pain, even hypotension. And they had to have a comprehensive echo performed within 12 months or 3 months after study enrollment. So 12 months before or 3 months after. They excluded pediatrics, prisoners, and non-English speaking patients. This was prospective, observational, cohort, and a convenience sample. They enrolled only when there was a trained investigator available and if the emergency physician was concerned about acute decompensated heart failure. They got all the vitals from the case. They all got 4 focused cardiac views, and then they visually estimated the EF, put it into either hyperdynamic, normal, reduced, or severely reduced, and then they obtained their MAPSE and their EPSS measurements. Further chart abstraction, they looked at the disposition, comprehensive echo results, some troponin or BNP levels, and then they also, importantly, calculated an inter-rater reliability for all the subjects by 2 different people. So that is always helpful to assess the accuracy of a new test, or at least the feasibility of a new test and how it lines up when 2 different people are doing it. Their primary outcome was the test performance of the MAPSE less than 8 millimeters. That was their cutoff for normal at detecting a reduced LVEF, which they defined as less than 50% EF on a comprehensive echo. Secondarily, they looked at that inter-rater reliability, correlation of MAPSE to the EF, predictive performance, and then comparing the MAPSE to those other measurements that emergency physicians commonly use to evaluate the EF. And with regard to a question we always ask, who is doing these ultrasounds? Well, it was one ultrasound fellowship trained attending, plus another ultrasound fellow, plus a couple residents who were all at least third year residents. They didn't receive too much extra training, just 1 hour of hands-on training, and everybody who enrolled patients had to perform at least 2 supervised scans before they could enroll. We don't need to dwell too much on their protocol for this because it was really just a normal focused cardiac ultrasound with your parasternal views, your subxiphoid, your apical view, and then they also just added on that MAPSE, which, just to tell you, it's always easy to look these things up, but it's as simple as putting an M mode over that lateral mitral valve annulus in the apical 4 chamber view. And you're just measuring it highest point to lowest point. So from the top of the mountain to the top of the valley. So Craig, what did they find in this study?
I think this is interesting because there's also talk of using the septal mitral valve annulus, which I think has had actually better outcomes and predictive values for other things. So it's interesting they use the lateral. So going through the results, and then we'll chat more about Craig's feeling. That's just like ultrasound therapy for me. So they had 61 patients with a median age of 72.64. They had pretty like baseline sick patients. So 60.7% had heart failure. 75% had shortness of breath. 18% had chest pain. 13% went to the ICU. 70% went to the floor. And 8% went home. So on discharge from the hospital, 62% of these patients ended up with an ultimate diagnosis of decompensated heart failure. The majority of these scans were performed by their residents, and about 40% of their patients had a decreased EF on their reference standard. And 22% of these patients had a MAPC below the cutoff value of 8 millimeters. So what they were looking at is how good is MAPC essentially for diagnosing abnormal EF? So sensitivity, not great, 42%. However, the specificity of a MAPC less than 8 for heart failure or reduced EF was 89%. And I think we often say the word heart failure interchangeably with reduced EF, but we have to keep in mind that there is preserved heart failure and diastolic heart failure. So anytime we're mentioning it here, we're talking about reduced ejection fraction and heart failure. I think that's a really important distinction to make and can get complicated a lot in a clinical setting. So in regards to MAPC, it had a positive likelihood ratio of 3.9, looking at it with the other outcomes, so the other measures they used. The EPSS had a much higher sensitivity, but a lower specificity, so a sensitivity of 92% with a specificity of 60%. Your eyeball gestalt, which is everybody's favorite because fastest, probably not cardiology's favorite, had a sensitivity of 100% with a specificity of 59%. And I really liked what they did when they started combining, saying, what if we do two of these? What if we do three of these? How well does that work? And I liked that because sometimes we're like, I think my eyeball's right, but what test should I do next? Or what if I did another test? And they actually had pretty good outcomes when they did the combined. So if one of the things, MAPC, EPSS, or visual estimate, were abnormal, your sensitivity, pooled sensitivity was 100% with a specificity of 50%. If two or more were abnormal, 80% sensitivity, 86% specificity. Interestingly, if your all three were abnormal, your sensitivity dropped to 44%, but your specificity rose to 94%. One beef I will say is they didn't look at the specific combinations, and I think I would have really liked to see that. So like visual plus MAPC or visual plus EPSS. Like I would have liked to have seen that breakout because I think I like a good algorithm and I like to be efficient. So like, do I really need to do all three? Do I just need to eyeball plus EPSS? I don't think this fully proved their point, because if their point was visual plus MAPC is the best, I would have loved to have seen that in the data. So that's kind of my commentary here for this. So they found, they tried to look also, even though they said 8 millimeters was their cutoff, they looked at anywhere between 7 and 10 millimeters at the MAPC to see where the best MAPC was, and came out that 8 millimeters seemed to be the ideal cutoff. They also were looking, did some secondary outcomes looking at EPSS, and is 7 millimeters, which is kind of the textbook answer, a good cutoff, and had better detection of abnormal EF at 11 millimeters, which kind of makes sense because it's really bad heart failure at that point. So there was a lot of interesting things that came out of this. I don't know if it solved any problems for me.
I agree with you, Cray. It kind of is similar to what you might expect. Like, it's okay for a test. And I think the authors make the claim that it had the highest specificity compared to those other ways of estimating it. But if you look at the confidence intervals, there's a ton of overlap there. So I wouldn't say it's really the de facto winner in any regard. Actually, it has a worse sensitivity compared to at least the visual estimation and the EPSS. But maybe combining it is the way to go. You know, it doesn't take a lot of extra effort to add a MAPC on. So if you're doing that and you're estimating it, maybe you're doing an EPSS too. It's just another piece of information that could help you figure out exactly what the heart's doing.
Yeah, I really would have loved to see the breakout of that combined, because the way the numbers look, it feels like visual for that sensitivity, something's not right. And then MAPC for that specificity, this is definitely decreased ejection fraction. Feels like a good combo, but we don't know what their combos and their pooled sensitivities were that gave them those numbers when it was two or more.
Exactly. And the author said something really interesting, too, that the MAPSE might be abnormal in patients with the preserved EF, as contrasted with the other ones, which would theoretically look normal in a preserved EF. I'm not exactly sure about that. I couldn't really follow a lot of reference for it. It's an interesting idea, because if you can have something that you can quantify, aside from doing all the diastolic measurements that are somewhat time consuming, but if you wanted to get a one-stop shop and you could do the MAPSE and it could identify if there's heart failure, whether it be systolic or diastolic, that would be kind of helpful. But it doesn't look like it panned out that well.
When I've seen that quoted in some of the diastolic literature where they're using the septal MAPSE as a surrogate for like tissue Doppler, right? Which makes sense that like it, because we use TAPSE for right heart compliance issues. So it makes sense that MAPSE, like with a preserved squeeze, but maybe reduced compliance, would be abnormal regardless. It's just, I haven't used or talked about MAPSE in probably a decade. It's outside of like an educational setting.
Yeah. And we haven't even touched on what I think is my biggest beef with this article. And that is the reference standard, the comprehensive echo. It could have been even a year before they were doing these point of care scans. That is problematic to me.
Oh, that's a crazy soapbox.
First of all, it's great to compare to their prior echoes. I think that should be encouraged. But to assume that nothing has really changed from up to 12 months prior, and so like to use that as the standard to say how good is the MAPSE or any of these measures, that could be really far off from the truth. So I am hesitant to really hang my hat on this data, because it would have been better if they did a echo on all of these patients and they compared it to like an echo that was done within 24 or 48 hours, then I would feel more confident that this is similar to what could be found on a comprehensive echo.
And I wonder if that data just wasn't available to them, though that seems a little shocking given that, what, 64% of them were diagnosed with heart failure on discharge. I would hope there was an echo somewhere along the line in that hospital stay, but I even have beefs with echoes 12 hours prior. So 12 months definitely doesn't sit well with me.
I think at the end of the day, the MAPSE is not really going to rise to fame, at least in the point of care, acute care setting, because it's not strong enough, at least based on this preliminary data, to supplant the use of these other measurements. So I think our end result is that you can get it, you can look at it, understand that it's not the strongest test, but maybe it can be helpful in some scenarios. So to summarize this article, it's a prospective convenience sample of 61 emergency department patients. The MAPSE, as measured by POCUS, had a specificity of 89% with a positive likelihood ratio of 3.9 and a pretty poor sensitivity for indicating a decreased EF on a comprehensive echo. Take-home points: the POCUS-obtained MAPSE correlates with the ejection fraction on a comprehensive echo with a, let's say, fair specificity and a poor sensitivity. There was good feasibility and agreement for obtaining a MAPSE in the emergency department in this small study. Thanks to the authors for putting this out there. Always fascinating to look into these alternative metrics that we can measure. And thank you, listeners, for standing by us till the end. We hope you'll go to our website, ultrasoundgel.org, where you can check out the show notes and a few other resources. And until next time, we'll talk to you later.
More pressure, more gel, more pressure, more gel.
Jinx. Mike. Okay, you can talk, Mike.
That would have been dangerous. I would have owed you a soda pop.